I'm Dr. Brent Schillinger, along with my colleague, Dr. Abby Strauss. The opioid-related topic today is recidivism and mortality after in-jail buprenorphine. And this comes from a paper recently published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence. Joining us to fill in the details is the lead author, Elizabeth Evans. Liz is Associate Professor of Community Health Education at the Department of Health Promotion and Policy at the School of Public Health and Health Sciences at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Clearly, the take-home message, your conclusion here is, yeah, this is a good thing. The folks who you followed through are less likely to get arrested and arraigned, or less likely to go back to jail. But I want to jump right in at the raw data. In the paper, you state that 48% of the experimental group versus 62% in the control group that they did not end up in the recidivism category. I was curious, there's something in the conclusion that there was a 29% reduction in recidivism. When I do the math, I see like 14% less, or as if you take it a percentage of the 63%, it shows that the experimental group did 20% better. Where does the 29% come from? How significant is this? Significant, but from a practical point of view.
The 29% reduction is the regression modeling that we did. So we did survival analysis. So that's when we account for other factors that differentiated the populations in the group that had access to buprenorphine and the group that didn't. And once we account for other differences between them, then we come up with this 29% lowered risk of recidivism if they had access to buprenorphine compared to if they did not while they were incarcerated. You could also look at those raw percentages, but 29% accounts for other things that might explain these outcomes that we've seen. And holding those into account, we then attribute the jail itself, the access to buprenorphine, as explaining this reduction.
So it's basically a complex statistical formula.
Yes.
So with that in mind, I still would ask the question,
yeah.
How impressive is this from a practical point of view? You're still looking at 48, almost 50% of the people in the experimental group still experience recidivism.
Mm-hmm.
So is that hugely impressive in terms of practical application?
I think so. I think when we first saw these results and working with our analyst and with the co-investigators, we kind of did a high five with each other. It was a confirmation of our hypothesis and not a small or negligible difference. This is a pretty significant one to see such a reduction in the risk of recidivism in the context of receiving the medication versus not.
What has been the response to you folks going to the jails and saying, you're giving these folks, this population, narcotics. You're supposed to fix them. This is the Department of Corrections. Correct the drug abuse problems. What's the response?
I come from, I'm a public health scientist. I've studied addiction for more than 20 years. Most of my work is looking at people over their life course and what explains the causes and consequences of addiction, but really focus on how do people achieve recovery. Much of my time has been focused on people with opioid use disorders, and we see that people can achieve recovery, and it's often attributable to them receiving those FDA-approved medications for treating opioid use disorders, buprenorphine, methadone, and naltrexone, but that very few people ever do receive those medications. And instead, over their life, they spend much more of their life course incarcerated, where they don't have access to those medications historically. There's a big shift underway now. Here in Massachusetts, there is a shift to the jails actually deciding, hey, what we're doing and have done is not helping us to avoid preventable deaths, or maybe contributing to it instead. So we should look at the evidence on what works for helping people avoid death among people who have opioid use disorder. And maybe we should think about providing these medications inside the jail. So that's really where this study originated. When I arrived in Massachusetts a few years ago, I was pleasantly surprised to learn that a local jail here was one of the first in the country to be providing buprenorphine to people who had opioid use disorder while they were incarcerated. They were one of the few, I think less than 5% of jails offer that. It may not be typical what we see in jails around the country, but it is significant, and it's like a shift towards a public health approach to addressing the opioid epidemic inside the criminal justice system.
Is this group of prisoners also required to be what are variously called drug cells, drug groups, NA, AA meetings, and the like, the non-pharmaceutical approach to treatment? Are they required to be engaged in that concurrently?
Yeah. So this jail that we studied has those forms of services available. People are able to take advantage of that. Every person has the choice to decide their treatment inside the jail. So they're not mandated to either take the medication or to take part, let's say, in the self-help groups or AA or NA or other like psychosocial treatment, but it is available. And I think it's strongly encouraged, but ultimately it's up to the individuals to decide in consultation with the physician who's treating them what care is best for them.
Because of your timing, you were actually able to conduct what you might call a natural experiment. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
One of the jails that we worked with was providing the medication. And in the same time period, a neighboring jail was not providing the medication. It's this idea of just a natural experiment, meaning we did not have to randomize people to a condition of receiving the medication or not, or to one jail or the other, which is ethically not possible. Instead, just by the natural way of things happening, one jail was offering buprenorphine and the other wasn't. So it was a chance to see whether the outcomes would be different in one jail versus the other.
How many years difference was there between the group that received the MOUD and the group that didn't? How long a period was there that you were following?
For both jails, we studied everyone who left either of the jails between, I think it's 2015 to 2019. So there's a four-year period where everyone exiting the jail who had an opioid use disorder, we studied all of them. In that four-year period, one jail was providing buprenorphine, but the other wasn't. Then after exit from jail, we followed people for a year, at least a year, to see what happened to them after exit from jail and whether, let's say, the recidivism rate or the mortality rate was different depending on whether they received buprenorphine while incarcerated.
So most of the research that has been done up to now is looking at physical health risks. Looking at continued drug use after release, overdose deaths, infectious diseases, that type of thing. Your research took a different focus. How is it different and what was the motivation for that?
Thanks for noticing that. We focused on recidivism. So this return after having been incarcerated, a return to a reincarcerated setting, like having been returned to jail or prison, or being rearrested or a probation or parole violation. So any of those events counts as a recidivism event. And we focused on that because that's an outcome that's of real interest to the criminal justice system. One of their main goals is public safety and protecting the community from harm, from crime. Our paper wanted to shine a light on whether receipt of this medication had an impact on the risk of recidivism, because it would have implications for criminal justice systems elsewhere considering whether or not to provide this type of medication. You can imagine sheriffs and others who are responsible for this institution, our jails and prisons. You know, one of their main priorities is to understand how whatever it is that they do with individuals who are incarcerated, how does that relate to the public safety or threats that that person might pose once they are released from those settings. Our study was unique in that it focused on recidivism and showed that in the context of having received buprenorphine, people were less likely to be rearrested or to have probation or parole violation.
This is very interesting. When someone comes in, is there a concurrent psychiatric evaluation, and are there criteria that would prevent someone from going into the MOUD programs?
It's a great question. It's one of the first things we asked when we got to know a little bit more about the operation of the program inside the jail was, well, how do you assess for opioid use disorder? Is this a universal assessment, which is what we would prefer, like everyone be assessed for OUD upon entry into the jail? It turns out that this jail does do that. They also use other things besides self-report of symptoms. They use the DSM criteria for determining diagnosis of an opioid use disorder. They also check the prescription drug monitoring program data to know if the person has been prescribed MOUD just prior to their incarceration. And so that's an indication that they are being treated in the community with opioid use disorder just before becoming incarcerated. They're also able to test urine to see whether it tests positive for those medications. This jail happens to do assessments through self-report, but also through administrative data and biological tests.
What about if somebody had legitimately been prescribed various opioids for pain? Is that considered an MOUD issue? I'm interested in where you draw the line.
I think they apply the DSM criteria for determining an opioid use disorder. So I guess if the opioids are being used appropriately and it's not yet on the threshold of meeting the criteria for an addiction, they would not necessarily be eligible to be in the treatment program for addiction. There is a physician on site at the jail who is a specialist in addiction medicine. I hear what they say that they do, and this is what they explain to me.
Going back to Abby's question, is there an assessment for psychiatric comorbidity?
Yes. So they do an assessment and also self-report of symptoms and also checking for receipt of psychiatric medications just prior to incarceration. So they have several different ways that they do assess for that. 80% or more of those who are incarcerated in these jails in our study have depression or anxiety. And about, I think it's a little over 35% are receiving psychiatric medications when they're admitted. Quite a large portion of them do have a co-occurring mental health condition in addition to their opioid use disorder.
So if they're in your program and they do well, and I'm reading some of the other media pieces that you've discussed, trying to essentially get case managers to set them up with post-incarceration treatment, that could be quite the challenge. Mm. Is there a more common than not reason for recidivism? Is it because your medications are okay, but they slip back into the world of criminal activity? What brings them back? What brings them back?
Not just our study, but others have indicated that when people are taking the medication as prescribed and their addiction is being managed appropriately so that they're not experiencing withdrawal or cravings and can feel normal in their life while they're taking those medications, they don't have a need to try to, let's say, steal property to sell it in order to buy drugs on the street. It's this idea that as long as their addiction is being managed, they don't have a reason to seek opioids, which then causes them maybe to engage in crime. And so as far as what causes them like recidivate, is those medications are effective only for so long as people continue to take them. We see when people discontinue their medication or maybe their dosage changes such that it isn't as effective as it once was, then they're maybe more likely to go seek illicit forms of opioids on the street.
As I hear this, and I applaud your work, it then becomes an obligation on the part of society, with all the nuances of what the society means, to help these people get into situations so they continue to get the treatment. These medications are not inexpensive. How do you do that? I remember once being part of a group where we were teaching medical students to work in a clinic, and everyone is writing a prescription for this and for that. And at the end of the day, somebody went behind a cafeteria and found so many of these prescriptions on the floor because these people had no access. They had no money to buy these prescriptions. I don't even know how to say this. Are you successful in preventing the relapses, in the social workers and the case managers keeping them in programs? That's my curiosity.
I agree with you. We need to provide greater access to these medications. And so the criminal justice system is one place to do that. Fewer than 5% of jails or prisons in the United States provide these medications now. We know people with opioid use disorder are likely to be in those systems. So here's an opportunity made available there. That's happening now in the United States that we're studying. What does it take to implement these medications inside jails and prisons? And then what outcomes does that have down the road? There is still the issue, though. Imagine how prior to changes like this, someone could be on the medication when they become incarcerated and then taken off, right? Because the jail doesn't offer them. That's a situation where they're undermining someone's ability to achieve recovery. We need these medications available. Of those who do receive medications in jail, they are more likely to continue it in the community than if they did not receive those medications while in jail. But that reentry is a tough transition. Jails are doing things like creating reentry programming to do like a warm handoff from the jail to the community treatment program so that within a 24-hour period of leaving jail, they do go enter community opioid treatment program to continue their treatment.
That's very good. One of the things that data very beautifully identify is the reduction of overdose deaths when people are discharged into a program. It's not unknown to people in addiction treatment. It's that people get off the medicines, go home. They went back to prior doses, and this time it's enough to give them respiratory depression and death. So you prevent a lot of that. That's really good.
And I think that data, you know, Massachusetts produced a study a few years ago that showed like the risk of death after among people of OUD and after they leave jail or prison, that 2-week period after exiting an incarcerated setting, they were 120 times more likely to experience an overdose, a fatal overdose event. And so that really shone a light or pointed policymakers in Massachusetts to the criminal justice system as a place that is an opportunity to do much better. It speaks to what you were just saying. If people aren't incarcerated and not receiving the medication, then they leave those places and are more likely to continue to use opioids at a level they were using when they entered the setting, which is now a lethal dose for them.
Is your data coming to, shall we say, persuade insurance companies to be more open to pay for this? Or is there a public health program in Massachusetts for those who have no insurance so they can get the medications and they can get treatment? You're doing good work, then you put them out, you graduate them from your program, but there's no place for them to continue with that. That's my worry.
Certainly yeah. The case in Florida.
In Massachusetts, the state's form of Medicaid does cover these medications. One challenge, though, is that when they become incarcerated, their Medicaid is put on pause such that when they exit, they have to reactivate their health insurance through the Medicaid program in order to access it when they go get care. So something that jails are doing now actually is recognizing this is a problem. They need a form of ID. They need this health insurance activated. So we, as individuals who help with reentry, can make this a part of our job. We're going to help folks who are leaving jails navigate this by working with them to reactivate their access to Medicaid as they leave jail, and then ensure they have all the paperwork in hand to be able to go enter care in a seamless way. That's the goal.
Back to the specifics of your study. There were less than 500 inmates. It was 2 rural county jails, mostly white men in their mid-30s, and they returned to small rural communities. The question is, can we extrapolate this data to other settings, to urban prisons, to minority populations?
It's a great question. We recognize that as a limitation of our studies. Right now, we're engaged in a larger study where we will be able to replicate this with a greater diversity of jails and populations. We're working with 9 jails now in Massachusetts who are delivering similar programming to see how outcomes look different for different types of populations.
We know that recidivism, reincarceration are costly, but so is implementation of MOUD. How do we convince policymakers that this is the right thing to do?
I can refer to one of the landmark studies I helped to direct a few years ago in California, where we looked at a new proposition called Proposition 36 that provided nonviolent drug offenders the opportunity to receive treatment instead of incarceration. And there was a cost-benefit analysis. We found that those who received treatment instead of usual criminal justice processing had better outcomes. So they were less likely to recidivate, more likely to be employed, and to have other positive outcomes. And when we put a dollar figure on those things, it turned out that $1 invested in treating them saved $7 in the long criminal justice costs. Reincarceration and those recidivism events that I talked about are also very costly, and maybe more so than treatment itself.
So you also did some work, what I found interesting, on gender-tailored methods, differences between men and women in mental health issues and opiate issues. Are you measuring those variables, other demographic variables in your study?
In future work, we will look at differences by gender, race and ethnicity, age, the comorbidity, co-occurring mental health conditions, and probably also polysubstance use will be important. We do expect to see differences in outcomes according to those factors. I study the health of women with addiction, and there are some factors unique to them that heighten their risk for addiction or make them less likely to engage in care. One of them, for example, is fear about what might happen to children who they are caring for. So this idea that by asking for help, they're worried that it might jeopardize their parental rights.
I think it would be fascinating if I could offer a question in your studies, is to use as a parameter those who have some sort of very significant traumatic background. Because these people tend to be very slippery. It's a horrible, I wish it wasn't. They tend to be slippery. If you could see that the ones who were recidivistic had more of a traumatic background, not necessarily a depression per se or for anxiety, because those are manifestations, but look a little bit more into their background, that might give you the sense to predict more about who was going to come back? I think it would be a fascinating question to look into.
You might have read my dissertations. I focused on adverse childhood experiences and how that relates to people's risk for addiction as they age and how it's different by gender. So this idea of experiences before the age of 18 of sexual or physical abuse or neglect or household dysfunction, and that those are sort of like persistent underlying risk factors for addiction that can last someone's lifetime. It's true, though, that people can cope with those events and there are other ways to ameliorate those effects, but not everyone has access to those resources. So I think you're right on that accounting for early life events and how those can play out in the health in our later life are very much something important.
And to dovetail, if someone gets out of jail and they don't have to go look for their drugs, they can mm-hmm. then spend the time, energy, and their own resources, pray tell, putting their life together in a better, easier way. They're not as handicapped.
Some of the stress and coping research shows with those experiences of childhood adversity, people are more reactive to later stressors in their life. I could have an experience of childhood adversity, but you don't. And then let's say we're both in our 40s and we have a very stressful life event. I'm more susceptible to react poorly to that life event because of my history of childhood adversity than you. So this idea that childhood adversity could kind of prime people for the proliferation of the poor impacts of stressful events later in life, really interesting.
We've had a number of discussions about the whole ACEs. In terms of intervention, just being able to talk about it seems to make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Among this population that we studied who was incarcerated in these jails, I think it's something like 85% have, I think it's something like 5 or more ACEs. They have very high ACE scores in general. So it's a normative reality in this population in particular, very high rates of exposure to childhood adversity.
Summing things up, you have some very impressive data, but you're also in a very progressive state, Massachusetts. Has this data been appreciated by any other states? Have there been any bites yet? What do you know about our state of Florida?
We have done some national presentations involving our criminal justice partners who have like photographs of what the jail and the treatment setting looks like inside the jail. So I think it's this idea of exposing people to a model of excellence and then connecting them to resources who also operate jails who can help implementing something similar in their jail, in their state. It's true, Massachusetts is, I would say, on the cutting edge of doing this. We can see it's feasible and learn from their lessons learned to maybe make it easier for places elsewhere to implement similar programming.
But part of it is that some people think that if you go to jail, you're not to be corrected, you're to be punished, mm-hmm. even though it's usually the Department of Corrections. And that attitude can be very difficult to overcome, and especially if you're giving them opioids, these types of medicines in jails, and they're not inexpensive.
Mm. I come from public health, so it's all about viewing addiction not as a moral failing or entirely as a personal choice, but also determined by people's contexts and other factors above and beyond their personal selves or decision making. Punishing people isn't going to solve the problem. In fact, it's likely to just worsen it. It's another stressor in their life that becomes a reason why they continue to use the substances. I was raised during the war on drugs. Criminal justice approach to the drug problem mostly hasn't worked in my mind.
I look at all these other psychosocial issues as spinoffs of the work that you're doing. You are establishing something that works reasonably well, and it'll get better with more research, more experience, but you have a very good, solid message.
Yeah.
How do we take your good message and extrapolate, extend, fund, et cetera, what's necessary to maintain your excellent observations?
I was going to add, right now, we are working on estimating the cost of a program like this one, and there will be then a cost offset analysis. Given how much a program like this costs to implement, and now we have the outcomes in hand and what are the costs associating with those, do the benefits outweigh the costs? In a future session, we could talk about the economic analysis if you're interested in that. Based on prior work in other places, if people engage with treatment and avoid rearrest and reincarceration, my experience is that it tends to be more of a benefit.
What do you have in the pipeline, so to speak?
I'm leading what's called the Massachusetts Justice Community Opioid Innovation Network, MassJCOIN, study funded by the National Institutes of Health, NIH, National Institute on Drug Abuse. We're one of, I think, now 13 clinical research hubs, me and Dr. Peter Friedman. We're working now with 9 jails in Massachusetts to look at the outcomes and implementation and costs of their delivery of an MOUD program while they're incarcerated, and also to help them re-enter the community. It's a massive study that will answer, I think, some of these questions, response to some of the critiques that you've offered.
And I think that data will be so important, because when it comes to policy, so often it's all about the money.
We've been invited to give some early evidence to the Massachusetts legislature. And in Massachusetts in 2018, there was a legislative mandate. So a few jails stepped forward to pilot test. And those are the ones that we're now working with to study what happens as a result of this legislative mandate. The legislature very much wants to know, we mandated this, now what are the outcomes of it, and how do we use this to inform policymaking as this initial mandate sunsets?
I heard that the average cost of incarceration in Florida jails, I must preface this to say that if my number is off, I apologize for that. But the theme is here, that it was $21,000 a year to keep someone in prison for a year in Florida. Mm-hmm. In our discussions with that, we said $21,000, that'll buy a lot of psychotherapy. That'll buy a lot of treatment modalities. And the like, wouldn't it be great if we could get that money and focus it over using your data and then putting it into programs? So yeah. The cost analysis, pray tell, will be what we want it to be and very persuasive. I hope so.
Yeah, I feel like this is a teaser. It's like a to be continued episode here.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, we'll see.
Elizabeth Evans, thanks so much for sharing this important information. It certainly will be very interesting to observe the impact that your work might have on the opioid in jail arena as we look to the future.
Great. Thank you so much. It was great talking to both of you.
Thank you as well. Have a good day. Stay warm.